to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 21st of December 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It is the winter solstice today, so happy winter solstice to all of you listeners out there. And of course, it is also the beginning of the week, and that means that we have Max Musson here from Western Spring today to talk about the week's most recent news. And we do have lots of really interesting news stories to get into this week. Max, how are you doing on this final week before Christmas?
Well, I'm personally absolutely fine. I'm just grinding my teeth over the government's latest changes to the tiers and the lockdown kind of situation for Christmas. I think that for them to make the change that they have this close to Christmas, having told us all that we could have a 5-day window where we could all meet our sort of extended family, etc., is just unacceptable and very, very, very poor form. I think that the excuse that the government have used is that the virus is spreading more quickly than they anticipated, and that some of the hospitals are reaching capacity. And yet the information that's coming from hospitals is that they're nowhere near capacity, and that they're nowhere near the levels of capacity that were achieved last year when we didn't have COVID-19. And so we're left sort of scratching our heads, wondering quite what is the government's motivation for effectively closing down Christmas. It's interesting that the last time that Christmas was abolished or Christmas was banned was back in the 1600s, I think 1667 or something like that from memory, which was during the English Civil War. And the consequence of that was that there was widespread rioting in large towns and cities across the country where people didn't want to forego Christmas. And Christmas eventually passed, but the Christmas was still banned the following year. And again, there was widespread rioting in large towns and cities across the country. And this continued for a number of years until eventually the government gave in and then decided that, yes, they would reinstate Christmas. And so hopefully we won't have to go through several years of rioting before we get Christmas back again. But if you know, the COVID-19 virus continues to mutate, then Mr. Whitty and Boris and all of the others, the scientific advisory group, they will all have an endless line of pretext that can be used for lockdowns and tiers and all sorts of other oppressive measures that don't really seem to make sense.
They don't make any sense at all, do they? I mean, why tell everyone they can have Christmas and then tell them that they can't have Christmas and use the excuse, well, the virus is mutated? I mean, that's what viruses do. They mutate, they evolve all the time. I mean, people were saying recently, I've heard people saying, well, why are they having Christmas anyway? These lockdowns haven't solved the problem. They keep having another lockdown. Either don't have any lockdowns at all, or just ban Christmas this year. Just don't have Christmas this year. I've heard a lot of people saying that. This is obviously going to really upset a lot of people's plans. Is the food that people would have got in for this, the arrangements that they would have made for traveling. It's an absolute nightmare for people. Boris is really going to go down as probably the most hated Prime Minister of all. I thought Theresa May couldn't have been beaten on that account, but it really does look like Boris is just a total failure the way that he's dealt with this coronavirus. The Labour Party were saying during the week, look, the figures are increasing. We've got more and more people that are coming down with this virus. Shouldn't we be making some changes at Christmas? And right up until Thursday, Boris Johnson was mocking the Labour Party for this. And then he came on the news and he said, well, I just recommend that people have a smaller Christmas. You don't have to have three families there in your house. If you can get away with one family, then that would be better. And then 2 days later, that's it. He says, right, from midnight tonight, all of London is on tier four, all of the southeast, 17 million people, basically, are being told that they're not allowed to leave their homes apart from to go and pick up groceries. And it's right back to the same stage that we were at in March. And as you say, Max, what's happened to all the hospitals that they built? What has happened to these Nightingale hospitals? They can't use the NHS being overwhelmed as an excuse when they built those huge hospitals back in March. So yes, very, very, very depressing news story to begin with, but we have got a very, very uplifting news story to get into as well. And this happened last week. Judges actually defended freedom of speech. Judges have insisted that freedom of speech includes the right to offend in a landmark ruling which could help to turn the tide on woke intolerance after a feminist who called a transgender woman a pig in a wig and a man was cleared. Presiding over a case in the Court of Appeal, Lord Justice Bean and Mr. Justice Warby said, "Freedom only to speak inoffensively is a freedom not worth having." They added that free speech encompasses the right to offend and indeed to abuse another. The judgment from two senior members of the judiciary will set a precedent for future cases involving freedom of speech. And this is absolutely fantastic. This is going to set a precedent. And what was going on here? There was a debate that was going on. It was going on in public. It was going on Twitter. So lots of people were seeing it, and it was two people basically abusing one another. And the judges are saying, well, that's okay. If you want to call somebody names like that, you want to be offensive, then that is okay. It is merely an inconvenience. And if you compare that to what we do at Radio Albion, we don't try to be offensive. We don't try to offend people. We don't try to abuse people. But more than that, we are not entering into a dialogue with anyone. All of our podcasts are addressed to ourselves. The podcasts have tags on there that say Sven Longshanks, Max Musson. That's who it is addressed to. This case here was two people arguing on Twitter. Our podcasts aren't on Twitter. We effectively put our content out on our own website. And if anybody wants to listen to it, wants to engage with the content, they come to our website to engage with the content, to listen to the content. So because of this, I really can't see that a case could ever be made against anybody with their own website that is just effectively talking and recording or just writing stuff down and putting it on their website, because it's not like they're even entering into a dialogue with anyone else. And it's not like it's happening on a public platform like it was here on Twitter. This, I think, is very good news. There is more to this case that I'll get into in a minute, but I'll just pass it over to you for your comments on this, Max.
Well, I think, yes, this is very good news. It's about time the pendulum started to swing the other way. And I believe my entire life that that there should be the right to freedom of speech, and that there should be the right to say things that other people find offensive. And I just can't understand people who expect to go their entire life without ever being offended. It's just a totally unrealistic expectation on their part. And that there was another case which I can't remember the full details of, but which came to light this week, which involved police officers that were members of a serious crime unit somewhere here in England. I can't remember, as I say, exactly where it was, but these were officers who were recorded having conversations in private, where when they had those conversations in private, they used terminology and expressed views that were not woke, effectively. From recollection of having read the article, I think they were all disciplined for it, and some had resigned and some have lost their jobs. But the upon reading that article, it was and it kind of sort of fits in with the subject matter that we're currently discussing, that if you know, there's the old story, isn't there, that philosophers talk about, that if a man stands in the middle of a wood and shouts out and nobody hears him, did he really make a sound? And it's if a police officer alone in an office makes a statement which is regarded as offensive, did they actually cause offence? And so, you know, these are fundamental issues. And of course, anybody that's exercising common sense would say, well, obviously, if nobody was an earshot, then obviously nobody could be offended. And so therefore, the person that's made a statement couldn't be regarded as having given offence. And in the same way as you've just been describing with regard to the radio Albion website, only people who want to hear what we've got to say come to our website, and so therefore they've chosen to hear our views, and they've done that primarily because they agree with our views, and so therefore it is almost impossible for anybody to claim that what we say here is offensive, because we've given due warning that some of the views that we express here may be controversial, and people are making the choice that they want to hear controversial views when they come to this website.
Well, and the other thing is, I mean, what the judge is saying here, it is okay to be offensive and to offend people, and people should not expect not to be offended. I mean, we try not to be offensive here. As I say, we're very careful about what we say. But what the judge is saying here is, I mean, this woman was calling this transsexual a pig in a wig and calling them a man. I don't think we've ever come up with terminology such as a pig in a wig, and certainly wouldn't be addressing somebody directly like that. I mean, this is quite something that these judges have come down on the side of rationality, common sense, and freedom of speech. And really, I mean, the police should be protecting the freedom of speech rather than going around trying to arrest people for saying things that somebody somewhere might find offensive. The police should be protecting meetings of people with political views that are different to the establishment views, and protecting people such as Patriotic Alternative so that they don't get attacked by Antifa. Because this is all to do with freedom of speech. It is all to do with things that people are saying. Continuing with the article here. In February this year, radical feminist Miss Scottow, 40, was handed a 2-year conditional discharge and ordered to pay £1,000 compensation, with District Judge Margaret Dodds telling her, "Your comments contributed nothing to a debate. We teach children to be kind to each other and not to call each other names in the playground." But overturning the decision, Mr. Justice Warby explained that the relevant parts of the Communications Act were not intended by Parliament to criminalise forms of expression, the content of which is no worse than annoying or inconvenient in nature. Mr. Justice Warby also suggested that the prosecution had been an unjustified state interference with free speech. Lord Justice Bean said the appeal illustrated the need for decision makers in the criminal justice system to have regard to issues of freedom of speech. It's incredible. This judge is speaking. This district judge, Margaret Dodds, is talking to the woman as if she's a naughty child, and that it is against the law to disagree with anyone. That's what she was basically saying. You cannot disagree with a transgender. You have to be kind to them. You have to humour them. And in the heat of the debate, you mustn't call their names. I'm just shocked that a judge would think that it would be okay to actually say that to somebody. But thankfully, these justices, and the Lord Justice Bean as well, have put this right and said, well, no, that you do have the right to offend, and you do indeed actually have the right to abuse another when you're having a debate, and in public as well. This is the thing. This was in public. This was on a public platform. This was on Twitter that this was going on. This is a huge win for rationality, basically, and common sense. I was so pleased to actually hear about this, and also how it applies to us, because, as I say, when we're not engaged in debate with anyone on a public platform, we are just putting our content out on our own platform. And I dare say if I was having a debate with a transgender, I certainly wouldn't be calling them a pig in a wig. I would advise everybody to be as courteous as possible when engaging in dialogue with somebody else. And if you get to the stage where ad hominems are being used, then that really says that, you know, the debate is over. If you're using ad hominems, it's that really is the lowest way to actually say that you've lost the debate, isn't it? Because you're reduced to calling the other person by name. So I certainly don't approve of what was going on here in this debate, but I certainly approve of the judge's judgment on this, that it's certainly not against the law to do things like that. Have you got any final thoughts on this, Max?
Well, I was just going to say that where somebody is a transgender person and was originally a man and has changed sex to become a woman, then It is quite reasonable for somebody else to disagree with their female status and to claim and to state that in their view they regard that person still as a man because their genetics, their genome will still be the genome of a man, and you can't actually change that. No matter how much surgery you have on your genitals, your genome will still remain in accordance with your original sex, and so therefore it is a matter of fact that you are still a man. If you wish to use somebody's genome as the determinant of their gender, whereas somebody else who wishes to use a different criteria to determine somebody's gender may disagree, but it's just expressing a matter of opinion. It's not a term of abuse. And so to call a transgender person who's transferred from being a man into a woman to continue to regard them as a man, and to state that you continue to regard them as a man, is in my view perfectly valid. It's a perfectly valid point of view, and it's a perfectly valid point of view to continue to regard somebody who was originally a woman and who has transitioned into a man to claim that they, in your view, they are still a woman also. It's a matter of opinion, and it should be perfectly proper for you to be able to express your opinion in that respect. And if you are a trans person, then part of the price you pay for being a trans person is that you have to accept that there will be some people who will still regard you as being your original genetically determined gender, and you just have to grow a thick skin over it. There are lots of, I can't dance, I'm a terrible dancer. And if people mock me when I attempt to dance, then I just accept it in good humor. I don't complain that I've been abused and that they shouldn't be able to say that I can't dance, because it's fairly obvious from anybody that's got any appreciation of dancing skill that I'm not a skilled dancer. And the same goes for singing. I can't sing in tune either, and it doesn't offend me. I wish I could, but it doesn't offend me when people point out and laugh at the fact that I can't sing in tune. It's just a fact of life. You can't be everything, and you can't have every skill, and you can't have every ability. You just have to accept what nature has given you and be proud of the things that you do well, and accept that occasionally unkind people might mock you for the things that you can't do well or that you don't do well.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not very courteous to refer to the transgender as a man, but it is factually correct. That's what I mean. I mean, I would advise listeners to call people whatever they would prefer to be called, but the fact that transgenders appear to be so narcissistic that they think that they should be allowed to use the law to force people to conform with their own fantasies, I think that riles people up completely the wrong way, and it sets the public far more against them than the public would be if they didn't try to use these laws. I mean, if they were just nice to people, then people would refer to them in the way that they wanted to be referred. But the fact that they claim that they don't just claim, but they call the police up and try to get the police to arrest people for affirming statements of fact that somebody with XY chromosomes is actually male, I mean, that sets them apart from the rest of society. It makes them at odds to the rest of society. It says that they are hostile to reality and they wish to force their fantasies upon everybody else using the strong arm of the law to do it, which is it's abhorrent that they think they would be allowed to do that. And even worse, some police forces, like the police force involved here, has gone along with that. So thankfully now it's been cleared up, and hopefully we won't see any more prosecutions like that in the future. I mean, this is a really, really good piece of news. I cannot overstate what such a good piece of news this actually is. And unfortunately, of course, it contrasts with a bad bit of news that came out last week as well, which is the government grooming gang report. And this is the report that we actually had to get a big petition together to get the government to tell us that they were going to actually publicise this report, and only this isn't the report we were expecting. We were expecting Sajid Javid's government review. That's what the petition was about. That's what we wanted to see. That's what the Home Office was holding back from us. But in their response to the petition, they said they would be releasing a report later in the year that was based on that review. And this report has now been released, and it's led to a slew of headlines claiming that white people are responsible for the grooming gangs. It's more white people that are involved in the grooming gangs than Asians. And when we talk about Muslim grooming gangs, that's just a far right conspiracy, which of course is very, very disingenuous. And it basically it comes down to them lumping all child sex abuse in together. And then claiming that, of course, most of it is carried out by whites, because, of course, whites are the majority in this country. So if you lump all child sex abuse in together, then it's quite clear most of it is going to be carried out by whites. But what the newspapers have then said, instead of saying, well, that's all child sex abuse together, they said, oh, no, that's the grooming gangs. The grooming gang rapes are most often carried out by whites, which, of course, is completely false. Another thing that the report stated was that there was not enough information collected to be conclusive about Asian involvement. And this is because the government completely refused to record the ethnicity of offenders until very recently. And this report goes back about 10 years. And I have a good quote here that I found on a website which deals with this yesterday. If fewer than 80% of offenders are white, then ethnic minorities are clearly overrepresented. Yet the report refuses to acknowledge even this basic conclusion, instead stating categorically that it is not possible to say whether these groups are overrepresented in this type of offending. If that is really not possible to say, then neither is it possible to say whether whites are the largest group. So you can't say that Asians are not overrepresented because we can't actually tell. And then on the other hand, say, well, whites are overrepresented, because obviously you wouldn't be able to tell if whites were either, because you've only got whites and non-whites there. There's also no mention of Islam or Muslims in the report, apart from in one heading. And a final quote here from the piece I was looking at. They say, a simple look at all convictions for grooming gang offenders shows that 84% of them have Muslim names and only 6% of the population are Muslim. Mathematically, this means that Muslims are over 80 times more likely to be convicted of a grooming offence than a non-Muslim. And the report, that report, was carried out by Peter McLaughlin. He carried out that study. And the government's own report completely ignored that. So we've got headlines in The Guardian and The Independent giving out this false image that grooming gangs are mostly composed of white people. And the actual truth of the matter is, which was already established some years ago by Peter McLaughlin, is that Muslims are over 80 times more likely to be convicted of these offences. So it's a complete scandal, especially when you consider that the reason they said these offences were continuing to go on and why they had managed to get away with it for all those years was because the police were too politically correct. And now we see that this report that was supposed to leave no stone unturned is just as politically correct as the police, and is trying to cover up the fact that it was overwhelmingly carried out by Muslims. Max, I know you've had a good look into this as well. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, well, I think it's a non-report. It's a report which doesn't address the subject matter that it was intended to report upon, and it is 57 pages of dissembling and fudge, in my view. If you look at the content of the report, they don't examine the statistics in the way that you've suggested that they perhaps ought to examine the statistics. And it takes until they start to talk about the case studies before they even start to mention any kind of numbers whatsoever. And they start talking about these case studies on page 41. So they've gone through 40 pages of dissembling and prevarication before they even get to the case studies. And then in the case studies, in two of the four case studies that they look at, they basically confirm what has tended to be reported in the newspapers, which is that the overwhelming majority of the victims were white British, and that the overwhelming majority of the perpetrators were British Pakistani. But then in the in two of the case studies that they use, in one of them they point out that the perpetrators were from the white traveler community, and so they must have really searched high and low to find an example of a white traveler community committing this form of crime, so that they could include it as one of the only four examples that they were going to quote, so that it would appear that, you know, it constitutes 25, it represents 25% of the cases. And then the last case study, it just says that both the victims and the perpetrators come from a range of ethnicities. And so they've like completely fudged that issue. When in fact, as far as the public are concerned, the very first case of this kind of grooming gangs when it first came to light, showed photographs of the people that were involved, and overwhelmingly the people who were the perpetrators were Asian or Pakistani, and that has been the case relentlessly through virtually every one of the cases of this kind that have come to light, and there have been many, many of them, such that there can be barely a large town or city in England that hasn't had this kind of a crime committed against the vulnerable young white girls in that area. And so the conclusions of this report fly in the face of what the public have seen. The public have seen time and time and time again the photographs of the people who were the perpetrators on the front pages of our newspapers, and it's quite obvious what the ethnicity of those people is, and for the government to then turn around and say that there is insufficient evidence for them to determine the ethnicity of the people involved. Well, all the researchers would have needed to do would be to thumb through back pages of our national newspapers, and they would have come up with all those photographs that would have demonstrated the ethnicity of the people involved. So they can't claim that there is insufficient evidence to establish that there was a disproportionate involvement of people of Asian ethnicity and of Muslim origins. And it's just so disappointing, really, that the government of the day, the government that we have today, regards our population as being so stupid, almost blind, and that we wouldn't see the fabrication that this report represents.
Right, all they have to do is look at the names of the people that have been arrested and charged with this. Another thing they said in the report was that there's been overexposure of the grooming gangs that were Muslims, as if the left-wing media have been concentrating on these cases and hiding the white grooming gangs. Where are the white grooming gangs? You brought up one instance there of the travelling community. Well, was that the gypsy community? I mean, the gypsies are well known for prostituting youngsters. I mean, they do that in Italy and elsewhere, but I wouldn't say that they were white. So when they talk about the white traveller community, I think they may well be referring to gypsies from Romania there, or gypsies from Bulgaria, because, of course, Romania and Bulgaria are both white countries. I think that may be what's going on there, as I have yet to hear of a white grooming gang. And we have seen the odd white face in amongst the brown faces when we see the pictures of these people, but they've only represented, I don't know, 1-2% at the very most. And they've all been sort of Antifa types, probably even mixed race types. And it is shocking that they have done this. And to see the lies and the slander, basically, against white people by saying that it's white people that are responsible for this. I mean, how insulting that must be for these victims that have done their very best to actually get the truth out about this. And some of them have lost their anonymity so that they could actually speak about this. And they all speak about how there was a religious component to it. And they don't even mention the religious component in the report. They talk about ethnicity. Well, of course, you're going to get different ethnicities. You're going to get Somalians, Pakistanis, Kenyans, Afghanis, Indians. You're going to get all types in there. But the one thing that unites them all together is that the majority of them subscribe to Islam. That is the important part of the report that's been completely ignored. And I mean, it very well may have been in Sajid Javid's original government review, because they still refuse to actually make that public. And this report was apparently collated from Sajid Javid's government review. So what they've done, I think, is they've gone through his review and they've just left out anything that they think could contribute to tensions between the communities. Exactly the same reason for why these cases weren't investigated in the first place. So nothing has changed, has it? It's still exactly the same.
And it further reinforces the perception that the government are corrupt and can't be trusted. If we look at the Home Secretary's foreword, Priti Patel says the government has made it our mission to protect the most vulnerable in our society, prevent child sexual abuse, and support victims and survivors to rebuild their lives. In my role as Home Secretary, I am dedicated to giving victims a voice and securing justice for them. So you would expect that she's dedicated to giving them a voice, that there would be a considerable number of the victims would have been involved in providing the information that would inform this report. And yet, when we find out that there was the report obviously was produced by the Home Office, but there was an external reference group. And so there's reference made to this external reference group as if it provides a very broad base of knowledge that the Home Office drew upon in order to make sure that their report was accurate. And then when you examine who the people are that are in this reference group, only one of them is a victim. Everybody else in that reference group is a professional, academic, or political functionary whose best interests are served by the maintenance of the status quo. And so it's quite obvious why the report has come out in the way that it has. They've cherry picked people that they know can't afford to say anything that would be contrary to prevailing woke culture that exists within this government. And it's just such a shame. And, you know, just to show you how much dissembling there is in this report, if you look through the table of contents, you don't have to actually read everything, because it just becomes an endless spew of psychobabble after a while. But if you just look through the contents list, they talk about the implications for policy of establishing the true nature of child sexual exploitation. They talk about the scope and the purpose of the report that they're going to produce, and the way in which this will then determine the future strategy for tackling child sexual abuse. But they talk about they go through definitions. You know, what is a definition of child sexual abuse? What is a definition of a child? What is the definition of grooming? And they go through arguments as to a definition of grooming could be this, or a definition of grooming could be that. What is the definition of a group? And how does the definition of a group differ from the definition of a gang? You know, as if that's actually pertinent to this whole situation. You know, what's the definition of an offender? And what's the definition of a victim? And what's the definition of a modus operandi? So they're just discussing all of these issues which are nothing to do with the actual subject matter of the report, and are just purely academic things that are a distraction, really, from them discussing the proper subject material.
Yeah, they haven't included the victims at all. The victims have complained about that. And I think one of the case studies they looked at was a children's home that didn't actually have a non-white community in that area. One of the rare parts of the country that doesn't have a non-white community. And they used that as one of their examples of what went on in a children's home. It was, it's just absolutely shocking and predictable as well. This was predicted. It was predicted by Maggie Oliver, the whistleblower that blew the lid off this in the first place. And she was saying that that's all this is going to be is a complete whitewash, totally contrary to the promises that Sajid Javid made. I would like to actually see his original report. Perhaps there will be a petition saying, look, we still want to see the original review, not your censored report on that review. So, good bit of good news this week and a bit of bad news. Shall we get into our greatest Britain? It's about time for that, Max.
Yes, let's do that.
Yeah, we've got a really good one this week. He's actually number two in the BBC's 100 Greatest Britons, second only to Winston Churchill. And it's another engineer. This week, we're going to be talking about Isambard Kingdom Brunel. And I've seen a lot of the things that he created. I've seen these bridges. Of course, I've seen the Severn Bridge. I've seen the bridge over the River Tamar. Absolutely incredible things made out of steel that he created. Some of the most beautiful bridges and largest bridges that had ever been built. He was also responsible for building some of the largest steamships that have ever been built. And I think the actual picture of him, which I think I'm going to include on the picture that accompanies this podcast, is one of the best photographs that have ever been taken. It's him standing in front of these huge chains with this big top hat on, and he's smoking a pipe. It's a really iconic photograph from the Victorian age. Have you heard of Isambard Kingdom Brunel before I mentioned we were going to do this, Max? Do you know anything about him? Have you seen that picture?
I did learn about him in school, but I have to say, to my shame, I haven't really sort of read about him since. And so my knowledge of what he's achieved, I know that he is a renowned engineer from the Victorian period. But apart from that, my knowledge is fairly scant. From the sort of brief discussion we had before we started to record this podcast, you have sort of filled me in with regard to a number of his achievements, and he certainly seems to be this somebody of the caliber that we should include in as a greatest Briton.
Well, it's amazing that he came second in the BBC's 100 Greatest Britons, and yet most people aren't really aware of him. Everybody knows who Winston Churchill is, but you know, most people probably aren't quite aware of who Isambard Kingdom Brunel is. Well, he was born in 1806 and he died at the young age of 53 in 1859. He was an English civil engineer of French extraction who is considered one of the most ingenious and prolific figures in engineering history. Not just one of the 19th century engineering giants, but one of the greatest figures of the Industrial Revolution, who changed the face of the English landscape with his groundbreaking designs and ingenious constructions. And I'll just stop there because it mentions that he's of French extraction. His father was French, basically, and his father was brought up in Britain. And he's described as an Englishman. Isambard Kingdom Brunel is described as an Englishman, even though he's of French extraction. And this really shows us that the white race is one extended family. And if a family moves to one white country, it only takes a generation before they become naturalized. And of course, when we were talking about Ernest Shackleton, he was of Irish extraction. So, you know, I just wanted to bring that up, the fact that the white race is one extended family. And when we're living in one country or another, we become naturalized very, very quickly. It's the complete opposite to what we see when we see non-whites that come into our country. And the more the generations go on, the more they become separated from us. When the non-whites first moved to Britain, they wore a suit and tie, give it two or three generations, and they're now walking around in their traditional pajama clothing that they wear in Afghanistan and Pakistan. So there's a huge difference there that I wanted to make at the beginning here. And in case anyone says that Isambard Kingdom Brunel wasn't he wasn't British, he was French, because he was brought up in England and he was just of French ethnic heritage. He built the dockyards, the Great Western Railway, a series of steamships, including the first propeller-driven transatlantic steamship, and numerous important bridges and tunnels which revolutionized public transport and modern engineering through innovative solutions to long-standing engineering problems. During his career, Brunel achieved many engineering firsts, including assisting in the building of the first tunnel under a navigable river, the River Thames, and the development of the SS Great Britain, the first propeller-driven, ocean-going iron ship, which when launched in 1843 was the largest ship ever to be built. His achievements ignited the imagination of the technically minded Britons of the age, and he soon became notable in the country on the back of this interest, and with the advent of his steamships, he became world famous. And one of the most famous things that he did, when he built the Great Western Railway, which went from London to Plymouth, he then had this idea of, well, let's continue it and take it all the way to New York. So he built this big steamship as well, and it was possible to get on the railway and keep traveling and traveling until you actually ended up in New York. And this is why people in America are aware of the Great Western Railway. And sadly, in the 60s, they actually did away with a lot of it. They wanted to blow it up because they said that we're not going to use it and we don't want a chance being invaded by a foreign force and them using our railways, which is an absolute tragedy, because we used to have railways that went to all the villages and all the way across the southwest of England, and they actually got rid of a lot of them. But that's what he's most famous for, is the Great Western Railway. You got any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, just to really say that in that he wanted to construct a mode of transport that would get people away from London to New York, that was it displayed not just engineering prowess, but the fact that he was a social visionary, realizing that it would be important for the development of Western civilization for there to be an efficient form of transport from London to New York. And I think that the fact that he constructed the Great Western Railway and then had ships that could take people on from Plymouth all the way across to New York was a remarkable visionary feat on his part, basically.
Yeah, remarkable, really, when you think about it. And then now we got the planes that do the same thing. And he was the first guy to imagine doing this by steamship. Well, he was born on the 9th of April in 1806 in Portsmouth, where his engineer father was working on and designing block-making machinery. He was named Isambard after his French father and Kingdom after his English mother, Sophia Kingdom. And as I mentioned earlier, his father was an engineer, very well thought of engineer, and his sons were engineers as well. So again, we can see that these talents are passed down through the generations, and this was a time when the children would be brought up to do the same thing that the father did, and that was just the way that it was. None of this short-term, one-week contracts and temping and no security like we have now. You would be brought up doing the same thing that your father did. And the family moved around following the father's work, and Brunel had a happy childhood, despite there being consistent money worries due to the father often finding himself in debt. Isambard Jr.'s father was his teacher during his early years, teaching him drawing and observational techniques from the age of 4 and Euclidean geometry by the age of 8. During this time, he also learned fluent French and the basic principles of engineering through being encouraged to draw interesting buildings and identifying any faults in their structure. And I find that quite incredible. Euclidean geometry by the age of 8 and drawing and observational techniques by the age of 4. I mean, this is obviously some kind of child prodigy. He's obviously got a very high IQ. That must have been passed down from his parents. And I don't know how common this was, that children of a very young age would learn these technical skills. Do you know if this was very common, Max, or was this something that just happened to a few of them? Do you know?
I don't know whether how extensive it would have been. I concur with your observations with regard to people inculcating their children in the same line of work that they were involved in, because I think that that is something which creates great families that dominate certain industries and have particular expertise in the technology and the know-how required in order to be successful in those fields of endeavor. For my own life, I can remember my grandfather sitting me down and showing me a model steamship that he had built and built from scratch out of pieces of wood and bits of metal and odd screws and things, and sort of explaining to me how he constructed that, and also him pointing out physical proportions of the human body, and having little mannequins that he could position, and getting me to draw them and showing me statues that he thought were particularly good, and getting me to draw statues. So I think that there perhaps was a culture in times past where, you know, perhaps grandparents, instead of them just babysitting their grandchildren and sitting them in front of CBeebies as a kind of electronic babysitter, that those grandparents, where they had skills, would help to develop those same skills in their grandchildren.
Yeah, they seem to have, they've done the opposite today, haven't they? They want to take the children away from the parents as early as possible and have the state indoctrinating them. Whereas, as you pointed out there, when you had intergenerational teaching and you had everyone in the family doing the same thing, it meant that they could dominate, and it meant that they were really good at what they were doing. And now they want the opposite. They don't want that to happen. They want the children to be taken away, educated by the state. They don't want them following him in the father's footsteps. And the grandparents are just used as babysitters, instead of passing on all this knowledge and information that's been passed down the generations, which is how it used to be. When Brunel was 8, he was sent to a boarding school in Hove, where he learned the classics. Again, that's incredible, at 8 years old to be learning that. And it must have been hard for him to be taken away from the parents as well, but that happened quite often to young children in this age. His father was so determined that Brunel should have access to the same high quality education that he had enjoyed in his youth, that at the age of 14, the younger Brunel was enrolled at university in Paris. Brunel's father was so well thought of that after being thrown in prison over a debt of £5,000 when Brunel was just 15 years old, the government issued him with a full amount to pay his debts off, rather than see him accept the offer from the Tsar of Russia, on condition that he gave his word he would stay in Britain. So you just wonder what would have happened if he had gone to Russia, because Russia was really quite behind the rest of Europe. That's talked about in Adolf Hitler's Mein Kampf. That was one of the reasons why Hitler wanted to go into Russia and develop it, because it was slightly behind the rest of Europe. And you do think, well, you know, if they managed to get hold of Eisenbahn Kingdom Brunel, maybe they might have been able to advance. So he was obviously very much in demand, and the British government paid off his debts. When Brunel Jr. completed his studies at Henri IV in 1822, his father had him presented as a candidate at the renowned engineering school École Polytechnique, but as a foreigner he was deemed ineligible for entry. Instead, he studied under the prominent master clockmaker and horologist Abraham Louis Breguet, who praised Brunel's potential in letters to his father. And I discovered that horology is the study of the measurement of time. So there's actually a whole science there, studying the measurement of time. And in late 1822, having completed his apprenticeship, Brunel returned to England. And I guess we don't really think about it now that we have digital clocks, but actually the making of clocks and the clockwork and the mechanics that goes on with it and the miniaturizing of everything and getting it to keep time exactly. I mean, there must be a real art to doing that, I would have thought. Do you know much about horology, Max?
I don't know that much about horology, but I think that what's quite clear here is that as part of his education, Brunel was sent to study under people who were existing people who had established levels of excellence in particular fields, and it's kind of like his father was sending him to various learned people to become their apprentice and to learn from them in a number of disciplines, so that those disciplines could be combined at a later date to provide further sort of invention. You know, it may not necessarily have been that the father expected that Isambard would be a great inventor. He may well have hoped that he would do, and may have hoped that he would become a great engineer. And one way of making that probability, or put that possibility a probability, would be to send his son as an apprentice, as a kind of magician's or sorcerer's apprentice, to go and study under men who were eminent in their field already, so that he could learn from them and develop their skills further during his own lifetime.
Well, yeah, engineering is all about solving problems, isn't it? So you're going to really want to know as much as you can about different disciplines, and also about the natural world and how things work in the natural world, so you can apply that to these problems and solve problems, rather than just studying in one field like we do today and concentrating on that. He wanted him to learn about everything. Well, Brunel worked for several years as an assistant engineer with his father as chief engineer on the Thames Tunnel. And this was a project to create a tunnel under London's River Thames between Rotherhithe and Wapping, with tunnellers driving a horizontal shaft from one side of the river to the other under the most difficult and dangerous conditions. You imagine, this was the first time this had ever been done, tunnelling under one side of a river to the other. And it is said that the idea for Brunel Senior's method for tunnelling the Thames came from a type of clam called the shipworm that bores into the hull of boats. So you can see there where it's important to see what happens in the natural world and take ideas from the natural world and then convert them into the mechanical world and the engineering world. And this is the way that most of the things that we have work, is from originally observing them in the natural world. And this method that he had for tunnelling under the Thames was quite ingenious. The Illustrated London News describes it. The mode in which this great excavation was accomplished was by means of a powerful apparatus termed a shield, consisting of 12 great frames lying close to each other like as many volumes on the shelf of a bookcase, and divided into three stages or stories, thus presenting 36 chambers of cells, each for one workman, and open to the rear, but closed in the front with movable boards. The front was placed against the earth to be removed, and the workman, having removed one board, excavated the earth behind it to the depth directed, and placed the board against the new surface exposed. The board was then in advance of the cell, and was kept in its place by props, and having thus proceeded with all the boards, each cell was advanced by two screws, one at its head and the other at its foot, which, resting against the finished brickwork and turned, impelled it forwards into the vacant space. The other set of divisions then advanced. As the miners worked at one end of the cell, so the bricklayers formed at the other, the top, the sides, and the bottom. I mean, that is really ingenious, isn't it? I mean, I don't know if you can really imagine that from my description there. But you, I mean, this was a huge thing. Moving a board out the way, and you got all that water above you, and they're just moving this board out the way and shoveling the gunk out, and it's obviously got to go out the other end and then brick it up. You know, we don't really think about the way that they build these tunnels, but, you know, to bring it forward to today, think of the Channel Tunnel and how that was done, because that was just improving on this, basically, on this idea of having this machine that shielded the workers and doing a little bit at a time and then bricking it up afterwards. And it all came from this idea of the shipworm. Well, the composition of the riverbed was often little more than waterlogged sediment and loose gravel. And despite the tunnelling shield, two incidents of severe flooding halted work for long periods, killing several workers and badly injuring the younger Brunel, who had no further work with the tunnel. The tunnel was eventually finished and had been intended for horse-drawn carriages, but instead was used by pedestrians and became a tourist attraction. 30 years later, in 1865, the East London Railway Company purchased the Thames Tunnel for £200,000, and 4 years after that, the first trains passed through it. Subsequently, the tunnel became part of the London Underground system, and it remains in use today, originally as part of the East London line, and now incorporated into the London Overground. So they must have just done this just to show that they could actually do it at first. And it just became horse-drawn carriages and a tourist attraction. It's incredible when you think about that, just for the hell of it, just to show that we can actually do it without realizing what it was then going to be used for later on. I don't know if you've got any comments on that, Max.
Well, just when you look back at things that have been invented by people in the past, it's always interesting to look at the intricacy of the things that they've devised and to wonder at the intellects of the people that devised these intricate mechanisms. You know, we spoke about horology, the study of the measurement of time, which basically would have been the construction of timepieces and watches and clocks. And when you look at the intricate interconnection of all the various little cogs and balance weights and things of this sort that exist in the internal workings of a clock, it's almost a thing of beauty, and it's amazing to think that somebody sat down one afternoon with a pencil and paper and actually thought of that design and constructed it, or may have thought of a design which perhaps wasn't quite so sophisticated and slowly improved on it over time. And I know from my own schooling where I studied technical drawing, were involved on one occasion in drawing the profile of the tooth that would be on a pinion that would form part of a gearbox. And most people just think, well, you know, you have cog teeth on a cog, and would not necessarily think that there was any great art involved in carving the individual teeth on a pinion that is part of a gearbox. But there is a tremendous amount of skill and technique that goes into making sure that the profile of the tooth is exactly right, so that at any one point in time, one tooth is always in contact with another tooth. Because if you just have teeth that just catch on each other, then your clockwork mechanism will click as it goes round, and it will vibrate and click. And obviously what you want is a smooth action where the second hand goes round nice and smoothly. And even just designing a gearbox for a car or a gearbox for a steam engine, a tremendous amount of work would have to go into designing the individual teeth and the size of the pinions that were going to be involved, and the numbers of teeth would have an effect on the profile of these teeth to make sure that there wasn't the sort of continual clicking as they go round. And another sort of benefit of having the profile correct, so that at all times there would be one tooth in contact with another tooth, was that the teeth would be far less likely to break, because if the teeth are clattering together as they go around, then there is always the potential for them to break. And I can remember some years back looking at a number of great inventions from the past, and just looking at a car's gearbox and being completely overawed by the fact that somebody sat down one day and designed a gearbox. And they may not have designed the entire finished thing with all five or six gears and one reverse gear or whatever, but somebody one day sat down and conceived of a gearbox and conceived of a gear change mechanism that would seamlessly slide one pinion into place so that it would connect with another pinion, and so that you would change up a gear and seamlessly transferred across to another pinion, so that you could then be in another gear. You know, to actually think these things up when nothing preceded them, and you were coming up with you were devising skills and sciences and techniques out of nothing. Some of these people involved, and I'm sure Isambard Kingdom of Brunel would be one of them, must have been absolutely immense intellects.
Oh, it's absolutely incredible. I think a lot of it goes back to Archimedes' screw, didn't it? That was one of the first thing with the, you know, turning with like teeth in it. And I should imagine it, everything worked on from that. Archimedes' screw would that was used for transporting water, wasn't it, at first? But it was right. Turning and at the same time digging into something or carrying something. It's absolutely incredible the way these people work, and they really should be given more credit. In 1833, before the Thames Tunnel was complete, Brunel was appointed chief engineer of the Great Western Railway, one of the wonders of Victorian Britain, running from London to Bristol and later Exeter. The company was founded at a public meeting in Bristol in 1833 and was incorporated by Act of Parliament in 1835. And I have to make an apology here, because I said that the Great Western Railway actually went to Plymouth, and it doesn't actually go to Plymouth. It was Brunel's vision that passengers would be able to purchase one ticket at London Paddington and travel from London to New York, changing from the Great Western Railway to the Great Western Steamship at the terminus in Neeland, West Wales. So it was actually in West Wales there that the railway went to. Obviously, it did also go to Exeter and around the southwest, but they actually took off from West Wales. So I apologise for saying it was Plymouth earlier on. He surveyed the entire length of the route between London and Bristol himself, with the help of many, including his solicitor, Jeremiah Osborne, of Bristol law firm Osborne Clark, who on one occasion rowed Brunel down the River Avon himself to survey the bank of the river for the route. Now, would you really see lawyers and solicitors getting involved in things like that nowadays? I don't think they really like to get their hands dirty, do they? But this was quite an incredible vision to actually have this railway going all the way to West Wales and then building this Great Western Steamship as well at the terminus there. Now, Brunel made two controversial decisions: to use a broad gauge of 7.5 inches for the track, which, of course, we talked about in George Stephenson and how he set up a standard gauge. So this was a very, very controversial decision that Brunel made to change the gauge. And he did this because he believed it would offer superior running at high speeds. And he also decided to take a route that passed north of the Marlborough Downs, an area with no significant towns, although it did offer potential connections to Oxford and Gloucester, and then to follow the Thames Valley into London. His decision to use broad gauge for the line was controversial in that almost all British railways to date had used the standard gauge. Brunel said that this was nothing more than a carryover from the mine railways that George Stephenson had worked on prior to making the world's first passenger railway. And he proved through both calculation and a series of trials that his broader gauge was the optimum size for providing both higher speeds and a stable and comfortable ride to passengers. In addition, the wider gauge also allowed for larger goods wagons and a greater freight capacity. But after his death, the decision was taken that standard gauge should be used for all railways in the country. Now, this is really interesting, because after we finished doing the podcast on George Stephenson, you were telling me, Max, that apparently, and I don't know if this is legend or not, but the actual gauge of the chariot wheels that we had, the ancient Britons had when the Romans came here, was exactly the same gauge that George Stephenson came up with. And I think it was 8.5 inches or something? The original standard gauge?
It was 4 feet 8.5 inches, and it's believed, although that there is no sort of definitive proof, but it is believed that the chariots that were employed by the ancient Britons during Roman times had their wheels set 5 feet apart. Now, if you take the width of the actual wheel assume that was perhaps, 4 or 5 inches wide, then, and take half of that amount and then subtract that from 5 foot, or subtract twice that amount from 5 foot, it would come down to 4 foot 8.5 inches or thereabouts. And so it is quite probable that what is widely believed, and so therefore I suppose could be regarded as legend, is actually true, that the that gauge was based upon the 5 foot width that was adopted as the width for chariots during those early times.
So it wasn't just that this was used in the mines. This was a traditional British gauge that could have lasted for 2,000 years. At least,
before there were metal roads with tarmac, etc.
Yeah,
the roadways that traversed Britain had ruts made in them by the carriage tracks, and these ruts were roughly 5 feet apart.
you know, like railway tracks,
yeah,
all the way back then. At the original Welsh terminus of the Great Western Railway at Neyland, sections of these broad gauge rails are used as the handrails at the quayside, and a number of information boards there depict various aspects of Brunel's life. There is also a larger than life bronze statue of him holding a steamship in one hand and a locomotive in the other. But very, very sadly, the statue was actually stolen and has had to be replaced. And I think we'll probably leave it there, and we'll get into the innovations that he actually made with this railway next week, I think. Max, unless you've got anything else you'd like to add or anything else you'd like to say?
That's fine. This seems to be a good point to pause.
Okay, well, thank you very much for coming on today.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back in the new year. We have a round table next week, so I will say Merry Christmas to you now from Real Britannia. I don't know if you want to say Merry Christmas to the listeners, Max.
Yes, Merry Christmas to all of the listeners, and Merry Christmas to you as well.
Thank you, Max. Merry Christmas to you too. And we will be back in the new year, and of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.